This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And in this episode, I want to talk a little bit about one of the later phases of Mao's Cultural Revolution. By 1968, once the army had intervened to restore order, and once the kind of the civil war phase of the Cultural Revolution had run its course, the party institutes and Mao institutes the purge that really Mao had always really wanted. Firstly, the working class was purged during the 1968 initiative called Cleansing the Ranks, which was lifted really from the kind of the Stalinist playbook of doing things. The idea that after 1949, all sorts of class enemies had reinvented themselves as working class, had wormed their way into the party and into the new Maoist hierarchy, and now needed to be rooted out, that the revolution needed to go through a second stage of purification in order to ensure kind of political and ideological purity and the removal of any remaining hidden class enemies. Obviously, most of the people who were purged, put through self-criticism, who were driven to suicide or who were murdered, had absolutely nothing to do with any kind of opposition to the party. These were often people who lived fairly modest, if not slightly comfortable, existences before 1949, but who sort of remained in the memory of local party cadres who had previously been persecuted and managed to kind of escape with their lives, if not having all their possessions confiscated or destroyed, and now who were on a list somewhere and came back for further retribution. One of the interesting features of Soviet and Chinese communism and East European communism, 20th century communism, is, if you like, is its extremely detailed and long memory. The ability that once someone is designated as a class traitor or a class enemy, to wind up in that pigeonhole for life and a paper trail to follow them around. The next phase of this purification process was the Up the Mountains, Down to the Villages campaign, which focused on the students and young people. The Cleansing the Ranks campaign hadn't really bothered with them so far. But in 1968, Zhu Enlai appeared in Tiananmen Square on the 7th of September to stand in front of a crowd of Red Guards and revolutionary committees. And he said that basically young people should now be sent to factories, mines and villages to learn from the masses. And this is another key aspect of Maoist communism, that the peasantry in particular were the true revolutionary class, the revolutionary vanguard, and that they had something to teach the other social classes and groups about the revolution and about their role within it and about how to behave and function as perfect communist Maoist citizens. And it also featured this idea that comes up in totalitarian ideologies throughout the 20th century that work is somehow a transformative experience. You see this in various fascisms, you certainly see it in communism, that through labour, either the intellect is switched off and one can immerse oneself in the collective, you know, thousands of people toiling in the fields, or that the intellect, or even the will, or the spirit, or whatever term you want to use for it, is transformed in some way. That people, through physical labour, develop a completely different understanding of the world, and that this is the real education. One isn't being educated in anything intellectual, one is being educated politically, philosophically, and kind of existentially. In the following 10 years, from 68 onwards, really to the advent of Deng Xiaoping, who opposed the policy, you have a transportation of millions and millions of young people to the countryside. Their parents very often protested and begged and pleaded with party cadres to prevent this from happening, knowing that their children would face all sorts of hardships and indeed risks going to the countryside. There's a huge incidence of sexual violence against women on the peasant farms in the countryside, particularly carried out by local party cadres. And it would hardly be surprising if men and boys didn't experience at least some of the same. The official decree comes in December 68, and it comes in one of the sort of a typical Maoist aphorism. "We have two hands, let us not laze about in the city," said the People's Daily. And Mao, very often, when there was a sea change in policy, would communicate in a slightly cryptic manner through the People's Daily newspaper and other publications. However, to think of it as a reluctant and unhappy process of deportation by many of the students would be misleading. In many towns and cities, long, long columns of young people marching towards the station could be seen, and there were bands playing, and there was immense enthusiasm. There was an assumption, probably derived from Maoist propaganda posters, that some sort of utopia would be visited, some kind of Chinese pastoral bliss of tranquil fields and buffalo and that sort of thing were going to be experienced. In reality, as we'll see in a moment, was much, much different. But they would be taken on the front of every column were trucks broadcasting out Maoist speeches and patriotic music, revolutionary songs, and there were obviously references to Mao's Little Red Book. When some young people had heard Zhou Enlai speak in Tiananmen Square a couple of months earlier, they had left voluntarily for the countryside. They'd taken the initiative upon themselves. And these were, as you find in any mass movement, the kind of the small percentage who are the real zealots, the passionate and true believers. But they didn't really make up the majority of young people sent to the countryside. Obviously, on arrival in the countryside, the reality of endless and mundane back-breaking work sinks in, and students who are completely unsuited to that kind of physical labour are subjected to exhausting routines that the peasants themselves would find tiring and hard, but are more accustomed to, more able to cope with. If days in the field aren't bad enough, the complete lack of any sort of preparation for the campaign, as with most of the things in the Cultural Revolution,
is an idea that is really thought of in the spur of the moment. It may have been gestating in the Maoist sort of mentality for some years, but it is carried out without any planning. So in many villages across China, there's no accommodation. Young people are sent with an allowance to pay for some accommodation, but often this is confiscated when they arrive in the villages, often by the local party cadre or by peasants who are desperate. The desperation that the peasants feel is an acute economic one. China had not, by 1968, recovered from the Great Leap Forward. Famine had ended, but hunger and pockets of starvation had not. And the Chinese economy had been profoundly weakened by the Great Leap Forward, and the advent of the Cultural Revolution in 1966 had once again added to that chaos and added to shortages and hardships. So where young people were being sent, they were being sent from towns and cities where there were shortages anyway, but they were actually being sent to areas of acute hunger. And once again, this clashed with the fantasy that many young people had created for themselves. If you remember previously, I talked about the Red Guards. It's a couple of weeks ago. And there were opportunities for young people to travel for free across China. And so many of the Red Guards who had been to see Mao speak in Beijing simply engaged in a kind of a Maoist interrailing for several months at an end, travelling for free and seeing the country, the vast country that they'd been born in for the first time. And it was, for many of them, a very exciting and quite romantic period. And a couple of years later, you can imagine how these fantasies must have lingered. There was a belief among many young people who went to the countryside that there would be some manner of unlimited leisure time. There's all sorts of fun pursuits like hiking and skiing and swimming in rivers would be possible. And obviously, I mean, it shows a kind of a deep naivety as to what peasant life is actually like. The whole point about peasant existence is there is no time. There is simply manual work, eating and sleeping, and eating in this case if you're lucky. So there is a lot here about the kind of the meeting of reality and fantasy, where fantasy normally evaporates fairly quickly. There's an interesting postscript to this story. If you read...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Strange Rebels by Christian Carroll. One of the strange rebels in question is Deng Xiaoping, and he's writing really about the year 1979. Well, in 1979, Deng Xiaoping visited the USA, and he was stood alongside Jimmy Carter, arranging all sorts of nice technology transfers from America to China and trade deals and that kind of thing, and was highly impressed when he walked around American shopping malls and packed supermarkets and thought, this is how we do it. So he was invited to a dinner at the White House, and was sat amazingly next to Shirley MacLaine. These are the kind of encounters you really can't make up. And Shirley MacLaine, a liberal Hollywood celebrity, much in the vein of those you might find by now, lauded Maoist China. She had made a documentary film there about the simple, good peasant people of China, and she recounted a story to Deng Xiaoping. And it was a story of coming across a Chinese village and finding a professor of physics labouring and toiling in the field. And the professor of physics had said to Shirley MacLaine how happy he was to be able to toil with the people. And Deng Xiaoping interrupted and said, he was lying to you. And Shirley MacLaine has essentially nothing to say at this moment. And Deng Xiaoping said, he was lying to you. And by the way, physics professors should be teaching in universities, not working in the fields. And that really kind of encapsulates an interesting moment that I really want to focus on in the near future, on this transition from Maoism to what you might call, what David Harvey calls, neoliberalism with Chinese characteristics, whereby the last vestiges of Maoism were swatted aside, and the enthusiasm to undo Maoist politics, Maoist policies, was palpable across the country. One of the risks associated with leaving the towns and cities was that one's status as a Chinese citizen changed as well. There were restrictions on peasants moving from the land to the cities and back again, and students that left the cities were redesignated as countryside dwellers, and that meant they were no longer entitled to return. So it was a permanent state of affairs. There were some Chinese students who thought that believed the idea that the peasants were the essence of the revolution, in essence, the essence of real China, what it meant really to be Chinese. And they were enthused by the idea of getting to know them. And there's an interesting parallel between this period of time, not a direct parallel, but an interesting one nonetheless, between this and the 19th century Russian populist to the people campaign, where Russian populist parties, the Narodniks and others, organised a generation of Russian students and intelligentsia to go and live with the peasants on the land and to try to encourage them in the ways of revolution, and also to learn about peasant social organising and the mir and the village commune, the община, into the bargain. And so it was hoped that there would be this transmission of ideas from students to peasants and back again. And the reality in Russia is immensely disappointing, that the peasants have no interest in revolution and they have little interest in anything else other than the possibility of acquiring more land. The literacy levels are low and explaining revolutionary ideas is very difficult, and the notion of overthrowing the Tsar is seen as absurd and ridiculous, and many of the students are thenceforth denounced to the third section, the Tsarist secret police. And the thing that seems to be the parallel in those two cases is this sort of strange kind of pastoral fantasy that exists about peasant life. And I suppose it's a romanticism you see in many cultures. I mean, if you look at the romantic poets of early 19th century Britain, who looked at the evil satanic mills of the Industrial Revolution and harked back to a more innocent era, ignoring the fact that kind of more innocent eras never really are that innocent, and there are all sorts of advantages that eventually come with modernity. There are reactions to modernity pretty much wherever you go. This perhaps can be explained slightly in that manner. One underreported and understudied area of the Up the Mountains, Down to the Villages campaign are the levels of death amongst young people. Statistics vary, and there's obviously a complication with statistics in kind of collecting them in rural China, where often people went missing. There were, it looks like, a large number of suicides. Suicide seems to be a kind of a recurring theme throughout Maoist China, as a kind of a major source of morbidity. There were people that died in accidents. There it's possible at a greater rate than the indigenous peasant peoples. But also there was a great deal of violence. There was violence against newcomers for whom the local Chinese peasants had little time or sympathy. There were beatings when the students couldn't harvest or plant or do agricultural work fast enough. And there was violence when students stumbled into complicated peasant politics surrounding long-standing feuds, resentments, land ownership, the fallout from collectivization, the fallout from communalization, the fallout from the Great Leap Forward, and the kind of soap opera-y sort of stuff that happens in tight-knit communities. Often there would be work teams run by the army, the military discipline meted out on students who were essentially working as untrained conscripts was quite regular and often brutal and sadistic. Students could often wind up being beaten to death by soldiers. And as I previously mentioned, sexual violence against women was rife. Women who went to the countryside often tried to band together to protect themselves, but very often this was fairly useless, fairly ineffective. Now, one possibility here that helps to explain why Maoism so quickly crumbles after 1976 is that the last vanguard of Maoism at this point was youth, students, the kinds of people that comprised the Red Guards. And these are the people, if they survived the experience, who would grow up into adulthood, into their 20s and 30s and 40s, and become the next generation of main Chinese breadwinners and taxpayers. And so when they become disillusioned with Maoism, it's a real problem. Now, in The Cultural Revolution, A People's History by Frank Dakota, he has a really nice little vignette. He writes, "One young man in Hunan remembered his pride at being selected to work in the countryside in 1969. And now I simply while away the days. I've lost interest in books and newspapers, and I've lost any concern for the fatherland's future or mankind's dreams. I merely get through the motions by mechanically eating, working, eating again, as if I have become a mere beast working to earn a living." Now, in there, I think, is something really crucial. Firstly, the young man refers to the fatherland's future or mankind's dreams. These kinds of utopianisms that, again, you saw in early Stalinist Russia, people in the Komsomol believing that they were building the world of tomorrow, and the young people in China who went to the land, again, believed something equally utopian. You know, they wouldn't have volunteered in such large numbers. And the death of that idealism across an entire generation who experienced, after the first flush of the Cultural Revolution, the real realities of Maoism. They, in essence, went from being the perpetrators of the Cultural Revolution, you know, tormenting their teachers and things like that, to being its victims. It meant that the core constituency of later Maoism wound up deeply resenting the system that they had once supported. Maoism's undoing as well, and again, we'll explore this one later, is partly explainable by the fact that despite everything that was said about the peasants, no demographic in China suffers more than they do. They make up the majority of famine deaths, 1958 to 1962. And they get precious little out of Maoism. Some peasants benefit from the redistribution of land, but this is fairly fleeting. And the undoing of Maoism after 1976 suggests that they too have very little invested in the idea either. Anyway, there we must leave it. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. And I'll catch you later today, probably, or perhaps tomorrow, on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.